And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today's program we visit with journalist and author Poe Bronson. He's the co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing. In so many aspects of life, from the Olympics to business competition, certain traits or skills dictate results. Poe Bronson now joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to you, Mr. Bronson.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. Good to have you. It seems our society is geared toward winning everywhere, from grade school now to Wall Street and from sports to politics, with a very low tolerance and regard for losers and losing. Do you think the drive to win has just become too pervasive?
No, I actually think it's the other way around. I actually think that we celebrate winners because there's so few of us. And having been on tour for 8 weeks, I got to say, I think that a lot of people look at competition with, it's really fun to watch on TV. We love those food shows. We love the home shows, the design shows, the singing shows, the dancing shows. But when it comes to competition in our life, we are intimidated and stressed out. And I do think that there is a very wrong approach towards losing. I'll put it this way. In San Francisco, I help run all of youth soccer here. And I actually believe it's very important for young kids to get experience losing. What we tend to do with kids is we tend to shelter them so they don't have an awareness of losing. What we do is we just make losing scarier, make it more taboo, something that's never supposed to happen. And instead, rather than making losing something, hey, you lost, big deal, keep going. And if you can learn that, then you don't get intimidated by losing and you're willing to take the risks in competition. Healthy competition is to take risks normally constrained by fear. And it's fear of losing and fear of thinking that losing is so terrible that is making people less competitive.
What about the importance of inspiration as far as winning and losing? I'm thinking that tonight's the NCAA basketball championship, Louisville against Michigan, and Louisville is really pumped up because of the Kevin Ware broken leg incident, and they've dedicated this game to him. Does that really count?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Look at this a couple of different ways, which is, first of all, we all, when we're talking about competition, we all want to have intrinsic motivation. We all want to love what we're doing. And that's very important for successful long-term goal achievement of any sort, including winning at basketball. But it's also in the heat of competition that you can, on top of how hard you could ever push yourself intrinsically, you can do yet more. And certainly in the case of Michigan was coming in as a lower seed. I mean, Louisville's the number one seed. But Michigan's coming in, and through the heat of this competition, they have been pushed to find hidden reserves of effort and get into this game in a way that would not have been predicted. Now, specifically in the case of Ware and Louisville, you know, teams can bring out the best in people. And this is why we have a false dichotomy in our society. People hear competition and they have this devil's advocate reaction. But what about collaboration? I'm sorry, collaboration and competition happen side by side, such as on that Louisville team, inspired by their teammate. And anything that increases the sense of collective identity on a team can help bring out yet greater effort and synergy between the players. It's a huge factor. The trick is most of us, you know, we don't necessarily play on a basketball team, but we go to jobs. And on our jobs, we work on teams. And teams should, like Louisville, get the best out of us, right? But in fact, most of us, most knowledge workers, work. 90% of knowledge workers work on multiple teams. It's like belonging to Louisville and Florida and, you know, Florida Gulf Coast all at the same time. By having multiple teams, we diffuse this power of teams.
So you just mentioned this collaboration and competition. You write that the assumption that competition is the opposite of cooperation is untrue and that the hormones that drive us to compete are the same hormones that drive us to cooperate. Can you explain that and tell us about the hormones?
Yeah, so there's no doubt that testosterone is a hormone of competition, and that's long been understood. When we're not talking about testosterone, a few crucial things to know is we're not talking about just men, women and men both. Even though women have about 1/7 the amount of baseline testosterone as men, and its effect on competition is not baseline levels but slight adjustments in the testosterone level on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour, moment-to-moment basis. And women have slight fluctuations just like men do. And in fact, you can say for a chess tournament, when we think of testosterone as what it does to hitting home run balls, you know, but its effect on the mind is interesting. And in chess tournaments, those players who have the greatest pre-tournament increase in testosterone in the 24 hours before the tournament do best in the tournament. They compete very well. So testosterone is the competition hormone. But what's fascinating is it's also the collaboration hormone. A scholar named Eisenegger brought 120 women into his lab, and he gave them testosterone or a placebo. He didn't tell them which one, but he told them it was one of the two. And they played this economics game where you could share with your opponent or you could steal from your opponent. And after the women had played, he asked them, which hormone do you think you got, the placebo or the testosterone? And the women who had played selfishly assumed they'd been given the testosterone. But in fact, it was the opposite. They'd been given the placebo. And it was the women who had been given the testosterone who shared the pot with their opponent most of the time. A similar study out of Emory University looks at testosterone increases and team play in soccer and shows that those who have the greatest testosterone increases are the best team players. They collaborate beautifully with their teammates. It makes sense. In real life, we compete on teams, and you have to do both at the same time.
I was struck in the book about you're saying that motivation versus monitoring, that the more complex the task, the less management control should be applied. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So you go back to the early days of economics and Adam Smith, and here's workers making nails, and the idea is that, you know, you need to monitor them. You need to police them. You need to be like a parent saying, have you done your homework yet? Have you done your homework yet? You know, to get them to do their job. And as we've shifted into a different world and a different type of economy, a different type of work, that question has long been penetrated to sort of say, hey, is this still valid? What do you do? And really, the more heady and complicated the work, the less monitoring seems to help, though it is moderated significantly by whether someone's an introvert or an extrovert. Introverts really do not want to be monitored at all. They don't need anybody over the top of them. But extroverts actually need it. They need more stimulation. They need more interaction. And being monitored helps extroverts stay engaged because the work itself is not enough all by itself.
How can managers make a distinction
between an introvert and an extrovert?
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty obvious, I think, you know, but you can also do it somewhat by trial and error. Or there's a lot of different easy, if the manager wants to know this, there's a lot of easy, 15-factor questions that would ask someone whether they're an introvert or an extrovert. But you can pretty much just tell, you know, are they gabby? Do they like to talk a lot? Do they? Interestingly is that extroverts, you would think they would like to compete more. They tend not to like competition as much. Introverts actually really enjoy competition more. They feel like it's, especially when it's clear, when there's a clear rules and clear sense of why someone won and when someone lost. That's a scheme or a situation that introverts tend to really like. So I think that when we're monitoring, when you're wondering what does a manager ought to be doing, the science has shown more recently that intermittent monitoring is perhaps the best middle ground. That monitoring all the time doesn't work. It interferes. It makes people self-conscious about their work. They can't think and, you know, deal with someone being monitored at the same time. But if occasionally there's a check-in, that seems to sort of not be intrusive, yet also provide sort of additional, you know, it's a little bit of a policing force, but it gets people get their work done.
I found a lot of your findings so surprising, one of which was we always hear about the benefits of positive thinking. You found that negative rather than positive self-talk led to a more successful performance. What's the science behind that?
Yeah, you know, in our culture we have this idea, a lot of it is selling transformation irresponsibly. You know, we tell people you just have to have positive outlook, you have to put it in your mind's eye and it'll come true. And what's missing is the sort of critical thinking element, the fact that to achieve any goal in life, there are problems along the way. And you need to anticipate and strategize and problem solve around those problems. And if you don't anticipate those problems, you don't see those problems and try to figure them out, when they happen, they throw you off. Like, this isn't supposed to happen. I envision myself on the podium. So visualization is still a good thing. If you look at, like, in hockey, for instance, what the sports psychologists do, they don't have a team that has never won the Stanley Cup holding the Stanley Cup. They have their athletes envision a great game that they have played or a playoff series that they won, then something that really happened. And they use that as, and this is not a strategic tool, it's a motivational tool. It can, in the off season, increase someone's motivation by visualizing some peak moments in their career, but they have to have been real, not fantasy. You know, the studies show that when more people fantasize about a dream job, the less likely a year later they'll be employed in any sort of job. Those who fantasize about their dream date are less likely to be dating anybody a year later. I'm less than 50 years old, but I do have a metal hip. I have had a hip replacement a few years ago, and this one was interesting to me. They show that patients who, before the surgery, have a very positive outlook about how good it's going to be once their hip is in and how much they're going to be able to do worse 6 months and a year later than those who were anticipating all sorts of pain and difficulty and difficult rehab because it's anticipated, their mind was ready for it. And competing and performing is a lot about being ready for the real difficulty of it, so that you're not thrown off by just how much of a challenge it is.
I'm just thinking, I watch a lot of tennis, and you always hear, you see there are certain players that will be so angry at themselves when they make a mistake and talk to themselves and kind of diss themselves. And you always hear the commentators say how that works against them. So it's just so surprising that you're saying the findings.
That's not necessarily true. It's really interesting. There's been a lot of studies of tennis and many other sports where you wouldn't necessarily think that. I mean, it's not really a surprise that anger could be beneficial if you're in karate or in rugby or in tackle football or something. But anger isn't really a useful motivation, say, if you're playing the piano. It's too fine-tuned for something like that. But in tennis, many great, even golfers, harness their anger productively. Now, anger that's unleashed, anger that you can't channel, is definitely going to, where at the point it's going to be destructive. But getting angry at the ball, getting angry at the opponent, getting angry at a lines person can absolutely focus people's brains, competitors' brains, and they can perform their best very often in very angry moments. It's an individualized trait. So just to be clear, not everybody does well in that. And when they look at this, they measure state anxiety and these state traits such as anger on a temporary moment-to-moment basis on a scale of 20 to 80. And being super calm tends not to be good. Being super enraged tends not to be good. But most people either succeed, their zone of optimal function is often at around like a 30 or way up or between around a 65 to a 70. So it's really about half of competitors can get quite aroused, quite pumped up, and very focused in that moment, and they perform their best. While other people, they don't perform their best there. They perform their best not calm, but in a way sort of an anticipatory kind of calm, a sort of a focused calm rather than a relaxed calm.
We're speaking with Poe Bronson. He's the co-author with Ashley Merriman and journalist of author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with author Poe Bronson. His book is Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing. Poe Bronson, in the book you say that younger siblings are more competitive than the older ones. Why is that?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I found the signs. I never really gave much credence to birth order science. I had looked at it before when in our last book, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, and decided not to write about it. But when it came to the competitiveness, I found the numbers were quite striking. It's not that this is true in every family, but on average it's true across many families. The most striking example of this would be in Major League Baseball. In the history of Major League Baseball, there have been 350 pairs of brothers to play, from the DiMaggio's to the Alou's, and you could name many more. And in that history, younger brothers, when they reach first base, are twice as likely as older brothers to attempt to steal second base. They're not better at it. They're just much more oriented towards taking risks and going for it. And if you think about it for a minute, now to succeed in the world outside the home when you're a young kid, it means learning to keep going and never quitting, even though you're not the best. You're not the best reader. You're not the best baseball player. You're not the best chess player. You're not the best painter. There's always some other kid who can do these things better than you. And kids have a very strong tendency to want to wilt or hide and not go up against other people unless they feel like they're the best. Now, this is something that younger siblings get used to in the home every day. Because in the home, they're never the best. An older sibling is always going to be the best at everything. And the oldest siblings tend not to have this experience inside the home. Inside the home, they are the best at everything, and they only have to get used to not being the best, but keep going outside the home. And so it's the younger siblings that tend to grow up to be more of a risk taker, a little more flexible, open-minded, looking for alternatives, and have these sort of more robust competitive skills over the long term.
I know I was the youngest sibling, and I tended to be teased a lot more. And I think that probably had an effect on me growing up, or even bullied.
Right. Well, and it can certainly backfire. Like, you know, if a kid is too young and can't even remotely compete in any way with older siblings, that they can wilt from it and just get, you know, worn down. But if they have a way to hang in there and actually, you know, compete, we tell the story in the book of Honus Wagner, who was born in 1874 in outside Pittsburgh, and we told the story of him growing up on the sandlots of Pittsburgh. He was the fourth of five brothers. And he was carrying his brother's bats and playing in their games, and he couldn't hit it very hard, so he'd scrap out a single and then try to steal bases and, you know, get along that way. And it's quite a few of his older brothers did have professional contracts, but it was little Hans. Hans was actually German for being like the fat, bow-legged kid. And that was why he has the name Honus Wagner, was because that was a German nickname for basically a kid who shouldn't even be on the baseball field at all. He went on to become the most prolific base dealer in his league. Before there was Ty Cobb and Babe Ruth, there was Honus Wagner. Now, this is just to be clear, this is not the youngest sibling, but this is true of anyone who's ever been a younger sibling. So all but the oldest siblings will get this benefit because they have spent some time in their home where there is an older sibling dominating them. And that gives them the psychological training ground for what is actually more so real competition later in life. Siblings compete all the time, 3.5 times an hour. They argue, they fight. They fight over remote controls, food, parental affection, leg crossing, some invisible line in the backseat of the car. And all of this is sort of a training ground for the competitive psyche.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Poe Bronson. He's the co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing. On today's Topical Currents, the number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio at WLRN.org. That's radio at WLRN.org. You were just speaking of risk, and something I found interesting, you discussed gender distinctions when it comes to competition. You found that in the political arena, men and women have a very different risk tolerance. Explain that for us.
Yeah, and I want to say that Ashley and I were I mentioned this reluctance with the sibling order. research. Well, when it came to gender differences, we really didn't want to look at it. I mean, I didn't think it would be very meaningful and that the differences would be small. And when there's this tiny little difference between men and women, it's not really worth discussing and making a hay out of that. But these differences were so drastic that we eventually felt like we're all losers if we don't pay attention to this. So in politics, it's long been noted that when women run for office, they tend to do quite well, but that it's harder to get women to decide to run for office. And, you know, we didn't talk about it directly as, well, are women less competitive than men? But Sarah Fulton's work, she was out at Texas A&M, and she was polling state senators around the country. And her work was backed up by a study of Texas judges and a study of New York judges. Very interesting. It kind of changed the paradigm. And what she found was that when a state senator, this is someone who's already been elected to the state house and they're looking to run for U.S. Congress, make that jump, they're perfectly positioned, that when the odds of winning that race are below 20%, all of the competitors will be men. And when the odds increase over 20%, you start to see women entering the race. And when it gets up to 30 or 40%, more women will actually enter the race than men will. And it turns out that basically men are really good at ignoring the odds, while women are really good at ascertaining and judging the odds. And they're very accurate in this. The difficult thing in politics is that most, say, congressional races, you go up against incumbents, and incumbents tend to win 92% of the time. So it's very difficult to get women to run for Congress because they know that the odds are long. We had some recent victories there, but we're still at only 18% of U.S. Congress are women elected officials. And we need to do more about this. And part of this is understanding how women choose not to compete when they can't win. Women seem to be more focused on winning, men more focused just on competing itself.
Hmm. That's really interesting. That's such an interesting point. What are the other different – what other –
Well, this is the same – if you look at the same thing, it's kind of interesting because, you know, so this is certainly hurting women in politics, right? Some women are absolutely willing to do it, but when you look across the country, you know, only 4 American women filled out any paperwork in 2012 to run for governor of their state. Only 4 out of 180 million American women. And it's because these offices was going up against incumbents. But this same ability to judge risk accurately benefits women in other spheres. So on Wall Street, it's so fascinating. On Wall Street, female financial analysts are 7.3% more accurate than male financial analysts. Men tend to misperceive some of the risks that companies face, and so their earnings estimates are off. Women's earning estimates are more accurate than men. And so, you know, really, if anybody listening happens to own or run a Wall Street firm, you should be hiring more women for sure, because they only make up 16% of the analyst pool. They're really good at it.
Are these biological and hormonal differences? I mean, what do you attribute them to?
You know, yeah, it's a whole combination of things. And I think probably the most interesting, I mean, there are biological differences that are affecting this. And but there's also socialization influences. And I think the question is, in the book you write about some socialization factors that hadn't been talked about before, and I'd like to mention them because some of the biological ones have been mentioned before. And while women on average tend not to be risk takers, there are a subset of women who absolutely are risk takers. And you can actually see this in the length of people's fingers. It's interesting. I'll come back to this. But I want to talk about the sociological factor, which is from Joyce Benenson's work. And it has to do with when kids are little, whether they play in groups or play in pairs. And it's really fascinating science. It shows that we were talking before about how siblings competing all the time is like this training ground for the competitive psyche. Well, so is group-based play. Group-based play has that rough-and-tumble quality. And kids who spend a lot of time in group-based play, boy or girl, tend to develop these healthy competitive skills. kids who spend a lot of time in pair-based play take turns. They tend to bury or hide differences because having similarities is the basis for the pair-based friendship, and they tend not to compete or even play many games with each other. While in group-based play, they play a lot of games and they get used to this stuff. So what's interesting is that even by the time girls are 2 years old, they'll be spending two-thirds of their time in pair-based play and one-third of their time in group play, and it's the exact opposite for boys. And in those crucial years, this socialization factor gets stronger. By the time they're 5 years old, girls are spending close to 80% of their time in pair-based play, and the boys are spending about 80% of the time in group-based play.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we can do for our young girls, and I've got a my daughter's 8 now, and I first learned the science about when she was 5, and I felt like, oh my gosh, this is 3 years late, but is to actually get them more into group-based play, and they will learn these dynamics of groups that will help them long-term. And these do seem to affect their risk-taking perceptions over the long-term.
It's really interesting. We're speaking with Poe Bronson. He's the co-author with Ashley Merriman of Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing. It's their latest book. On today's Topical Currents, we'll come back, take some calls, and have more of Poe Bronson. Stay with us.
And 35 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Poe Bronson. If you'd like to join in the discussion, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. First caller, this is Francisco in Miami. Hi there.
Hello. I have a question for the guest, and it's pertaining to the cultural factors that may affect the individual vision of competing and winning. I'm referring to more collectivistic societies like, let's say, Latin American and perhaps Asian cultures, whereas European and American cultures are more individualistic and they're probably better fit or prepared in life from birth for competition than these other cultures where are more group collectivistic type of activities or upbringings, and whether that is a factor in terms of the development, economical development of the country, and also the democracy spread. You know, that would be my question.
Okay, let's take one thing at a time there.
Sorry.
It's a great question. Thank you, Francisco. I mean, it's interesting. So that thesis is a commonly intuited thesis. Definitely the science of collectivist versus individualist cultures shows some wrinkles and some differences, and I'll get into some of those. But it does not show that necessarily collectivist cultures are less ready to compete in any way than individualist cultures. And one of the things is that, as I mentioned before, a lot of what we do is competing in teams. A lot of we compete socially. We compete, you know, in a social environment. And competing also is stressful. And attitudes towards stress we can get into, but having a support group is crucial towards the long-term infinite nature of many real-life competitions. So while playing a board game or playing a soccer game lasts for only a certain amount of time, most real competitions in life go on and on and on. And having social support for that helps sustain that competitive ability over a long period of time. Now, some of the discrete differences, the clearest one is actually on, say, team negotiation. You get some of the opposite effects you think you would have. You might think that people from a collectivist culture are better, you know, on a team negotiation type task, but it actually shows the opposite. And what you see in a collectivist culture is that the participants are very focused on maintaining the relationships and the the respect within the team. And as a result, when a team hits difficulty, they tend to preserve team harmony over challenging and questioning and disrupting the team to say, hey, team, we have to do something about this. We have to get better. And actually, in an individualist, people from an individualist society, when they go to negotiate as a team, do better because the team is more flexible. It's not so focused on its own harmony. It's focused on the result. While in a collectivist culture, they're focused on the harmony at the expense of the result. So you can see these things a little bit here and there, say, in a business sphere. But and for the most part, I would say no. There's nothing affecting Latin America, say, from wanting every bit and caring just as much that they do well in the World Cup as any other country.
We have an emailer, Alan and Davey. He says, in coaching children, does your research show that the prizes for everyone and playing without keeping score and all the attempts to protect kids from losing are a bad thing? I've been worried about these things are actually making our young athletes lose an edge. You mentioned something
Absolutely.
About that before, yeah.
Yeah, and Alan is dead right on that. And it's... you know, we've had this impulse to sort of protect kids from competition, like to learn the skill and build up their intrinsic love of it and enjoy it. And I think that what people miss is that, like, if I watch my son and daughter and, you know, they brush their teeth and then they race to their bedroom to see who can get there first. When they get up in the morning, they have their breakfast, and then they race to put on their clothes to see who can get the clothes on first. They enjoy it. They find it fun. And the theoretical constructs we have around competition miss the fact that sometimes competing is intrinsically rewarding itself. Competing is fun. People don't like to lose, for sure, but they still enjoy the thrill of it. And when we have prizes for every kid, it's one thing if it's clearly marked as a participation prize, but if it's at the expense of there being some winners declared, it becomes hypocritical. Kids are confused. We just won the game, and you told me we didn't win the game, and parents make competition very confusing for kids. I think the most important thing is that when it comes to kids, is we don't realize how important it is to really teach an abiding respect for the rules, and we confuse behavior that is actually associated with breaking the rules. We don't see that it's associated with, we see it as somehow endemic to the game. A good example was I was in Detroit. I was giving a speech at the school, and they wanted to ban Foursquare from their playground. Foursquare is a game where there's four squares and a rubber ball, and you bounce it back and forth. And if you're out, you have to leave the game for a minute, get back in line, and there's, you know, someone who's in the King of the Mountain type square. And they said, like, that all the kids were too competitive, and they were cheating. They were throwing the ball rather than hitting it with their hands. They weren't hitting it upward. They were hitting it downward. They were saying the ball would be in, and they'd say it was out. And I said, look, rather than banning Foursquare, why don't you ban playing Foursquare against the rules? Teach them the rules and teach them to have this abiding respect for the rules. And that turned out to work really well. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, the first culture that really celebrated competition, far more than us, it's not just that they celebrated the virtues of competition, it was that they really took cheating so seriously, they did not forgive people. There was a boxer in the 4th century BC, Eupolos, who bribed 3 opponents and was caught. They memorialized them in stone outside the Colosseum for antiquity. These are the 4 guys that cheated. Imagine if on Wall Street we memorialized Bernie Madoff with a bronze statue for eternity, saying, you cheated. And if anybody else cheats, you are going to be in this square with your bronze statue for your children's 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 children to come see. Imagine if rather than arguing over whether Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame, he was memorialized outside the Hall of Fame. And we would not have people cheating if we took it more seriously.
So does that fall under the category of the maladaptive competition?
Yeah, and one of the reasons we have maladaptive competitiveness is because we're prone to this forgiveness. And, you know, kids make mistakes for sure, but, you know, it's competition can produce adaptive behavior or maladaptive behavior. Maladaptive behavior is the person who drags others into competitions they don't want to be in, who doesn't recognize the social circumstance. Healthy competitive skills is not just the ability to turn it up when it counts. It's also the ability to turn it down or totally off when it's not socially relevant. And anybody who's competing in those times, that's maladaptive competitiveness. And what brings that about, a lot of it, is this we have not taken cheating seriously enough and kept people from doing this kind of behavior.
What about just, isn't there a time and place for competition, though? Aren't there times when we should turn off our competitive impulse?
Absolutely.
You know, I mean,
I'll
in our personal
lives?
Fascinating
ones. I'll give you one of the most, absolutely, in our personal lives for sure. I'll give you the most fascinating examples to me is that this is science from Trinidad and Tobago, from charter schools in the American South, from a study of 5 million children in Britain, and a study of Chinese universities. And they all collectively show a pattern, which is that in elite competitive schools, girls do better than boys. Girls uniformly do well in elite competitive schools. There's a lot of resources in these schools. There's great teachers. And then the kids compare themselves to each other, but not to the point of tearing each other down. But in elite competitive schools for boys who go to these schools who do really well tend to go up and up and up and up. But if the boy is slipping behind in any way, that relentless tendency to compare themselves to others destroys their psyche, and they do worse over time, to the point that in these charter schools in the American South, a boy who got into his charter school of his dreams has a lower chance of going to college than a kid who also applied to the lottery but did not get the charter school of his dreams and had to go to, you know, the next best school or some other school, a less competitive school. Because those boys in that little bit less competitive school are handling the stress of competition better and learn more over time. It's shocking. The lesson isn't to pull your boys out of competitive schools. That's not the idea. The important lesson here is sometimes it's important to, on a day-to-day basis, to turn off that sense of comparing yourself to others and to save your energy for when it actually matters.
We're speaking with Poe Bronson. He's the co-author of Top Dog, The Signs of Winning or Losing. We have a couple of emails. We'll get to those when we get back. Stay with us. And we're back. It is Topical Currents for Monday. We're speaking with Poe Bronson. He's the co-author with Ashley Merriman of Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing. Do you have a website associated with you and Ashley and the or the book?
Oh, well, yeah. Topdogbook.com is the website. But Facebook or Twitter, I'm at Poe Bronson. And Facebook, it's Top Dog Book as well, Facebook/Top Dog Book. Readers can find us there, read more reviews, see many of the other interviews, that kind of thing.
Poe Bronson, could you touch on warriors versus warriors?
Yeah.
Warriors versus warriors, and how sometimes it's better to be a warrior than a warrior.
Yeah, so there turns out to we recognize a phenomenon where there seem to be some people who are terrific and very bright on a day-to-day basis, but under a lot of stress and pressure, they just don't do as well. You kind of can't count on them as well. Or it's the kid who is really bright at school, but whose standardized test scores are lower than they would be based on their daily homework, you know. And then there's the opposite phenomenon. There's people who maybe can sometimes be even a little bit lethargic or not as motivated, but when the stress and pressure turn up, they actually perform their best, and they actually do really well under stress and pressure. Well, we've all recognized this sort of dichotomy. It turns out that there's a gene for it. The gene is called the COMT gene, C-O-M-T. It regulates a COMT enzyme in the prefrontal cortex of the brain. And the what it actually does is it's adjusting the dopamine levels, the rate of dopamine gets recycled in the front of the brain. And you get these two different phenomena where dopamine is something that's released a lot during stress. So some people perform their best without stress. Some people actually cannot perform their best until there's stress. The stress brings their dopamine levels up to optimum in the front of their brain, and they think more clearly. This has been given the nickname of the warriors and the worriers, warrior-worrier gene. And intuitively, when people hear this, I know that they're thinking, oh, well, it sounds a lot better to be a warrior than to be a worrier. Warriors sound cool. You do great under pressure. That's what I want. And to be a warrior, well, it's nice to be able to do better on a day-to-day basis, but it'd sure be nice to do better under pressure. Well, a couple things about this. First of all, this is going to affect kids more than it's going to affect grown-ups, because as someone gets a lot of experience with regular stressors in their life, they begin to be able to get control of that stress response and not have that classic worrier response to stress. So airplane pilots who've had a few more years of experience, the worrier gene, the one that makes them worry, actually gives them a cognitive advantage, and they do better, say, in flight simulator tests. But the other side of this is to recognize just that being a worrier is not a bad thing. To worry is to think ahead. It is to plan. It is to see problems long in advance. And there is a reason. The warrior gene is one we share with apes. It's been around through all of human history. The worrier gene is a evolutionary new try. It's a mutation that has become extremely popular. It is now in half of all of our society. And it has gotten that way because it gives us this extra brain power when not under stress. It gives you a 10-point cognitive advantage in the front of your brain. And being able to think ahead, being able to plan, being able to worry and see problems is actually really healthy in our society. And it's something to – it might mean people don't handle the stress as well, but it's still an advantage on an everyday basis.
Is there a median ground?
Well, the median ground would be – so the way this gene is distributed is that both genes are equally popular in society. So one quarter of all people have worrier-only genes. One quarter of people have warrior-only genes. And half of all people have one of each type of gene. And as a result, they have both types of enzymes doing the work in the front of their brain. So half of our society is going to be at that median point, and they might feel like they have a happy median, or they might feel like, sure, I would like to do even better under pressure. Now, I am definitely a warrior. I am someone who, you know, I would never perform all that well on practice tests and stuff, but then put me down on the SAT and I get and I would ace it. You know, put me down on any sort of standardized test and I would perform really well. I like stress and pressure. My co-author, Ashley, is the opposite. She's someone who doesn't like the intense stress and pressure, but on a day-to-day basis, she is more motivated than me, helps me get going. I really need her because of her day-to-day advantages that she brings to the question, to the table.
So what does a worrier do in a warrior situation where being a warrior is required, but you're a worrier?
Well, first of all, is if it's ideally, it's some situation, let's say it might be work-related or something, where you're dealing with recurring stresses. You've seen these stress before. And then you're actually can handle it, usually handle it just fine. But if it's a novel stress or it is something where you are having that sort of too much dopamine mental overload, what it can trigger is a threat physiology, vasoconstriction throughout your body. You know, can't breathe as well and can't oxygenate the blood as well. And the best thing you can do is just ask for a timeout or to come back the next day. Because once it's triggered, once all that sort of threat physiology and the worrier response, the overloaded brain is triggered, you can't just fix it. You can't just fix it in the moment. You fix it by having a lifetime of habits and experiences over time. You know, Jeremy Jameson did this amazing study where he told people, he gave them the GRE exam, the graduate record exam, and half of them, he said, new science shows that anxiety can actually help you score better. And if you're feeling anxious, you might do better today. And they got 50 points higher than the control group. And when they took the actual GRE, it was 65 points higher. Mm. So developing a response where you see stress as beneficial can help people compete, help people perform better over time. In our society, we tell a story, I'm all stressed out, I'm not doing well, like that stress is always bad for performance. And that's not true. Novices and rookies and amateurs tend to find stress as detrimental to performance. But professionals and accomplished performers see stress as vital to their best performances.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. We've been visiting with journalist and author Poe Bronson. He's the co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning or Losing. Thank you very much, Poe Bronson. It's been a very interesting hour.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Want a friend to hear today's program? We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, wlrn.org. More info as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow's program begins with a discussion of reducing or eliminating meat from one's diet. Many school districts are moving to vegetarian menus. Also, literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez. And today's calendar, on this day in 1925, 88 years ago, the University of Miami is chartered in Coral Gables on 160 acres of land ceded by George Merrick. The first classes were held at the Anastasia Hotel. And on this day in 1974, 39 years ago, Hank Aaron of the Braves breaks Babe Ruth's career home run record with his 715th home run. Lefty Al Downing threw the historic pitch. One more while we fondly recall Queens and 704 Hauser Street. On this day in 1979, 34 years ago, the 204th and final episode of All in the Family on CBS. It said the longest laugh in television history occurred when Sammy Davis Jr. kissed Archie Bunker in thanks for returning his briefcase from Bunker's taxi. Carol O'Connor had declined the role of the captain in Gilligan's Island, and the original choice for Archie Bunker, Jackie Gleason. I could see that. We leave with a thought from Archie Bunker. That's the kind of poor luck Mr. Lincoln had the night he went to the movies, and he sat in John Wilkes' booth. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.